Hello and welcome to Be Curious Beings podcast with me, Seven Yelders. Isn't the natural world a curious thing? Have you ever wondered its purpose and reason? Perhaps its diverse environments and abundant ecosystems. Or maybe you're interested in the evolutionary and behaviour-based. Well, join me and discover all your curiosities within the wonderful world that is our planet. Listening to upcoming conservationists, scientists, and specialists within the area of conservation science to make you that little bit more curious about the place that we live on.
Hello, Katie. Thank you so much for coming on my podcast today. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling really well, thank you. Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It really is an honour.
I'm really excited. So I think firstly, it would be really interesting if you could introduce yourself and tell the audience what you're currently doing.
Of course. So my name's Katie. I'm a marine biologist. I'm currently studying my PhD at Stellenbosch University in South Africa, although sadly, due to the pandemic, I'm not actually in South Africa at the moment. So I am talking to you from where I grew up and my home in the Isle of Man. Yeah. And my PhD is looking at seagrass restoration and how we can improve the success rate of restoration efforts at the moment, because seagrass is so crucial and so important.
That's incredible. And I will ask you more questions about why it is important. But what could you explain to the audience what seagrass is?
Sure. So a common misconception actually is that seagrass is a plant that's found in estuaries in almost every continent around the world, except for the Antarctic. There is around just over 70 species of seagrass. So the species that I'm studying out in South Africa is Zostera capensis. And whilst I'm here on the Isle of Man, there is its sister species, Zostera marina. And yeah, seagrass is an amazing plant because it helps to absorb harmful carbon from the atmosphere, and then it buries that within its root system. So that helps to offset climate change. It also helps to absorb some of the wave energy coming onto onto our coastlines, so can help reduce economic damage in that way. It provides nursery habitat for young fish, so it actually helps support about a fifth of the world's fish stocks. So it's important not just for local fishermen for subsistence fishing, that's, you know, hand-to-mouth, belly fishing. It also supports a much larger fishing fleet across the world. And it's just an amazing plant. It absorbs carbon from the atmosphere actually 35 times faster than the rainforest.
Oh, wow.
But because seagrass isn't particularly charismatic, maybe it's, you know, coral reefs or mangroves, you actually don't hear about all these amazing things that seagrass can do.
Mm.
Yeah, so it's a little hidden gem.
I love that. I love that so much. That's incredible. Have you always been interested in marine environments? Has that always been a drive towards what you've wanted to do?
So, as I've mentioned, I grew up in the Isle of Man. We're a really small island. So, you know, I drive 20 minutes in any direction and I'll be on a beach. So I've always been surrounded by the ocean and the sea. Mm. But it really wasn't until I learned to dive that I became more consciously aware of my interest in marine biology. For my undergrad, I actually was more interested in terrestrial ecology, and oh. I did my undergrad in ecology and environmental management, and my dissertation was on the effects of artificial light pollution on bats. So it's a complete 180, really. In that
it is. Sense. It is. Wow, that's such a divergent. I love that. I love that so much.
Exactly. The passion for research was there in my undergrad. I just it took me a little minute to figure out what direction I wanted to take that in, and I did, during my undergrad, I did a year in industry. So I worked as an ecologist for a year. Mm. And because everything in the UK hibernates over the winter, I got the winter off because there wasn't work for me. So I decided to take a bit of a leap of faith and went out to Madagascar for 6 weeks and learned to dive. Yeah, and it just, you know, it was just this amazing time. I'd never done anything like that before. Like, I kind of considered myself adventurous, but actually, I wasn't really. I was really not.
I love that so much. You're very much like me. It was the same for me. I had the opportunity to go to Brazil, which I did go in 2019. But at the beginning, when they introduce it, you think, I could see myself going to Brazil and wandering the forests, God knows when. And I think as soon as I got there, and I think you may feel the same, but I think as soon as you get there, you forget everything else and you just immerse yourself in the environment. And I would really love to know what you saw in Madagascar before we carry on.
Yeah, so, I mean, at the time I went to Madagascar, it was the rainy season, which is a bit of an error on my part, but I didn't have the time off. So the first day that I actually went diving, it'd been torrential rain a few days before, and because of the amount of deforestation they have there, all the topsoil had just gone into the water, so it was really low visibility, and I actually really did not like the first day out diving. I had amazing teacher, so eventually she just grabbed my hand one day and was like, right, we're going.
Come on, let's go.
Yeah, and you know, I think once you just stop thinking about breathing, it sounds so simple, but actually that was one of the hardest things. It's like, oh my gosh, I shouldn't be able to breathe underwater. And yeah, then we saw sea turtles, nudibranchs, amazing coral reefs, and tropical fish, and I really started to get into the marine ID, the marine identification part of actually what I was seeing, because once you begin to recognize actually what you're seeing and all these amazing adaptations that all these different creatures have, that really starts to become like an underwater story for you, and you can figure out based on what corals you're seeing where you might be able to find it, so it becomes like a detective work, really. It was amazing. It's so cliche, but it really was.
No, of course not. I mean, there's been moments where you could have a very simple moment and it could be the life-changing moment of your life, and I really love how you saw a different world, and it really put it into perspective. I would love to do that, but I don't know how to dive, and I think breathing through my mouth would be so unusual to me.
Yeah.
If they told me, I'd be like, what? Surely not.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, when, you know, it was really out in the sticks, this camp that we were at. And when I tell people, like, usually when you learn to dive, you do loads of pool training first and do like some basic skills and things. When I tell some people that, you know, I didn't really do any of that, I just went out into the open water and kind of got stuck in, they're like, oh my God, that's insane. But actually, it's amazing, because I think you don't really get to appreciate how much of a different world it is once you're underwater, and like once you have that feeling of neutral buoyancy. You can get the physical sensation of the neutral buoyancy in a pool, but you don't get that sense of how 4D the whole environment is. I just think being underwater is like an entirely different world.
Oh, I bet, I agree. And I hope at some point I will take that leap of faith and actually do it, because I really would love to do that. It sounds so interesting, and just, I think I'd just be blown away with the amount of diversity underwater.
Yeah, you should. I would 100% recommend it. If you have a local BZAC group near you, I would 1000% recommend them. I originally started with Paddy, so they're the big guys of learning to dive, really, and did my open water and advanced open water. But ESAC is a really amazing organisation because it's all led by volunteers, so you don't have to pay as much money, which is the key aspect. That's the main barrier. People give up their time to give you the theory. They give up their weekends to take you on diving trips. I would 1,000% recommend learning through BZAC.
That's amazing. I love that so much. I guess the interesting part is as well, because I really want to get onto the study now, because I read the summary and it was incredible. So what does seagrass restoration mean, and through your study, what do you hope to gain throughout the procedure?
Sure, so that's a really great question. Seagrass restoration means being able to restore degraded reefs to, you know, a inverted commas healthy state, and that can mean doing a number of different things. So first we have to identify, you know, why is this patch of seagrass meadow degraded? Is there any human impacts causing harm to that area of seagrass, like pollution or overfishing? Or is it something large scale like climate change, where the water's warming, so it's struggling to photosynthesize, it's becoming too warm, it's getting heat stress, things like that. So restoration can come in a number of different forms. I'm going to look at three different ways. So we're looking at ecological, physiological solutions to this problem, because at the moment restoration efforts are only about 36% successful. As I keep mentioning, climate change is here and now. We're already feeling the effects of it all over the world. Mm-hmm. So we need to really be increasing the success rate of what we're doing. So the first chapter of my PhD is looking at something called translocation experiments. Simply, that's just moving small patches of seagrass from healthy meadows into degraded meadows to help bolster them, to help them recover. So we need to look at what size patches of seagrass we need. Do we need to take a 10 centimeter diameter core or a 50 centimeter diameter core to really for that to have an effect? And then how we need to spatially arrange those seagrass patches around the degraded meadow, so that we're getting it's a payoff between how much seagrass, what's the minimum amount of seagrass that we can take from this healthy meadow, so that we then don't degrade that one that has the maximum impact and the maximum recovery time and recovery rate at this degraded meadow. So that's the first thing we're looking at. Then we're also, so my second chapter of my PhD is a spatial modelling chapter. And that sounds pretty technical, but all we're doing there is looking at the lagoon that I'm studying, and looking at where's got the optimal conditions for us to be looking at creating new seagrass meadows, or, you know, what management can we put into areas that aren't optimal for seagrass restoration? Can we remove any threats that are currently going on in that area? So it's like a habitat suitability map, basically. So we can identify threats, we can identify key areas that are perfect for increasing the survival of our seagrass patches. So that's really exciting. That's more my background, so yeah, that'll be great. And then the final chapter is some genomics work. So that's looking at transcriptomics. And a transcriptome, basically, when you have your double-stranded DNA and then you cut it in half, so you have two strands of RNA, and you can look at that RNA and find out what genes are switched on in response to heating the plant. So if you put that plant under heat stress, because as climate change begins to take effect, most of our oceans and our estuaries are going to be starting to get warmer. So if that gene for cell degradation or cell death is turned on, then we know that that seagrass isn't going to do well as our waters start to become warmer. But alternatively, another gene could be switched on for cell repair or making photosynthesis more efficient. So what that's actually doing is showing that plant's adapting to the higher temperatures. So if we can then identify which of these seagrass meadows that are actually adapted to higher temperatures, then we can take patches of seagrass from there and we can use that and spread it further across the coast so that we actually end up with a much larger area of seagrass that's adapted to the future that we're going to have, rather than spreading seagrass around the coast that's not adapted to warmer temperatures. So it's about looking at where we're getting that donor material. And that's really exciting because I've not done very much genetics for it before. So yeah, I'm excited to get into the lab.
That is absolutely fascinating. And I was actually going to ask you about temperature. So are seagrasses well adapted to different environments? And is what, like you said as well, stresses of temperature, would that be a major impact? And what other stresses are involved, such as, I guess, pollution, littering? Could you explain that a little bit more?
Sure. So the ability of different species of seagrass to cope with heat stress varies wildly, even within the same species, because although you can have one species, they can be what we call genetically divergent, which means that you're almost getting into subpopulations, essentially. So the species that I'm looking at is Ostra capensis. A PhD student who used to be in my lab called Nikki, she surveyed Ostra capensis across the whole of the South African coastline and found that there were was like a subgroup of the species that could adapt to warmer waters, and there was a species that wasn't so able to adapt to warmer waters. So even within this lagoon that I'm studying, it's really interesting because it's the only place that this has been found in the world, is that they have both of those populations in the same place. So you've got warm and cold adapted populations that are the same species. But if we can take material from that warm adapted population and move it across the coast, then it's likely that it'll be able to withstand heat stress, as we have the effects of temperature are more intense, they're going on for longer, they're happening, heat stress events are happening over a longer time period.
Definitely.
And they're happening over a larger area as well. So that's really interesting. But the heat stress isn't the only threat to seagrass from climate change specifically. So you're going to start seeing more dramatic weather events. So a higher frequency of storms, maybe changes in current has also been predicted. So if you're actually in a warm current, that current might stop, or it might go the other way. So you actually, what used to be a warm water place actually becomes a cold water place, which is kind of against the trend. But other threats that we've already touched on include pollution. So if you have an output from a sewage treatment works, then that can increase the nutrients in the water column. And that means that there's more tiny little creatures that grow on the leaves of the seagrass, and they create a film. So the seagrass can't photosynthesize as efficiently because they're not getting in as much light because this film is blocking more of the light out.
Mm-hmm.
So it creates difficulties there, and things like overfishing. So a lot of boats fish within seagrass meadows, especially as they provide nurseries for small fish.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're overfishing in those areas, then you're actually just ripping out the seagrass directly. Exploitation as well. So within the seagrass meadows, you also get a couple of species of prawn. So we have the sand prawn and the mud prawn within South Africa, and people like to eat those. But in order to find those, you need to go through the sediment. So it creates a process called bioturbation, where you're basically just churning up that mud and sand, and you've got more sediment in the water. And it's the same process as adding more nutrients to the water. It creates murky water. So again, you're not getting that light through for basic photosynthesis that the plant needs to create energy. Energy for the plant. So there's a number of different things that are threatening seagrass meadows across the world at the moment. So climate change is kind of an umbrella for a lot of those.
Definitely. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, it's mostly human caused, unfortunately.
Yeah, I'm interested. If there is a lack of sunlight for the seagrass to absorb the heat and the nutrients of the sun, does it change colour? Have you seen that happen?
So I've never seen that happen, but so the seagrass can become sort of like anemic, so they can become like a really pale green if they're not very healthy, and eventually they will just go brown as they begin to die, basically, because they essentially become smothered by either the siltiness of the water, or because they've got these, you know, really extensive films covering their leaves, so they can't absorb that sunlight.
And when the seagrass eventually does die due to the lack of nutrients and sunlight, does it actually have a purpose for other species to eat, something to maybe restore some sort of nutrients within the meadows?
Unfortunately not. So usually it's kind of seagrass creates a cycle for itself, because it's something called an ecosystem engineer. So without seagrass, you've usually just got plain sand or mud. But when that seagrass begins to colonize those areas, it begins to change the chemistry of the environment. It changes the ecology of the environment. So it becomes a food source as when it's alive for things like turtles and dugongs. And then it starts to really create an entire food web, with itself being at the basis of that, as it becomes a nursery for small fish or a breeding ground for seahorses and things like that. You know, in some areas of the world, you'll start getting apex predators around seagrass, like sharks. But as it begins to die, what happens is that you get a negative feedback loop. So it's sort of like water circling around the plug hole, because as more seagrass dies, you're getting less roots to be able to bind that sediment. So more sediment is likely to go back into that water column. And as I've said before, we're starting to then make it more silty. Less seagrass is getting less light, and more seagrass starts to die. And then we just keep going around the same loop until eventually it's gone. Usually when it dies, it kind of just gets pulled up and washed away. It doesn't help keep that really important network of the root system, the seagrass, because their roots don't go down very deep, but they do create a mesh across across the sort of initial surface of whatever sediment they're in.
That is incredible. That's so fascinating. And I think what I find really interesting is when I was reading your PhD, there was a statement that said that seagrass meadows are as diverse as rainforests.
Yeah, so I mean, it depends where you are in the world and how diverse they are. Mm-hmm. But I mean, yes, seagrass, and without seagrass, you lose this entire ecosystem of, you know, young fish, prawns, mm-hmm. even those tiny little animals that form the film on the seagrass, which to some degree is normal, but if you, as I've said, if you add too much nutrient, then it becomes overpowering. Mm-hmm. All the way up to the food web, to the dugongs and turtles. It's just that usually seagrass is found in muddy or sandy areas, and because it's all green, it sort of looks like a monoculture, just like the grass outside your house. So, you know, it's not maybe as photogenic or charismatic as rainforests or coral reefs, as I've said. But actually, it still is really amazing. Mm-hmm. So it's a humble plant that really does have hidden secrets to it, think.
No, I really agree. I mean, it's just it's just a gem. I didn't realize the extent of the ecological purposes of seagrass, and this is so fascinating to me that I just want to learn more about it. And I think another question I wanted to ask is how does seagrass contribute to humans' well-being? What kind of value, let's say, does that hold?
I think that's a perfect question to ask. So as we start to kind of see climate change coming towards us, we have to begin to start kind of allocating conservation funds to different habitats, to different initiatives. And a way that we do that is to assess ecosystem services. Mm-hmm. So that's the things that each of these habitats are naturally providing us as humans without being paid per se. They're just things that they automatically do. So in South Africa, seagrass actually contributes 3 billion rand the South African economy every single year through the ecosystem services, such as absorbing carbon from the atmosphere, shoreline protection from storms through absorbing wave energy, as fish nurseries to support fishermen. So, you know, it provides us with clean water, food, coastal protection. Mm. Also, just in terms of some of those less economically tangible benefits, that is beauty, a sense of place, a sense of purpose. Seagrass in a lot of South African communities has cultural significance as well, as they take the seagrass, usually really sustainably. They harvest the seagrass and braid that to make baskets and things that they will use within their communities. So it's also used in some communities to have a religious significance as well. A lot of things like baptisms take place in estuaries surrounded by seagrass.
Wow.
So it starts to become a place of provides a sense of purpose for people, especially if you're in a coastal community. These things are less easy to place a price tag on, but actually, if you ever are lucky enough to go to an estuary and see seagrass, it really is beautiful when it's absorbed in the water and it's just swaying with the tide and things like that. Unfortunately, the UK Zostrum marina, the sister of the species that I'm looking at, is usually found at sort of like 5 meters depth. So So you'll really have to go snorkel and find that. And yeah, some species are found even deeper. So yeah, it really is. It's beautiful.
That's incredible. And I want to also know about the reduction in coral disease. So how does seagrass play an important part in that?
Sure. So an amazing thing that seagrass does automatically, and this research is still ongoing at the moment, is that it provides a buffer for coral reefs. So because of the water purification aspects that seagrass provide, they also help to reduce the pH of the water. So a massive threat to coral reefs at the moment, because the oceans are absorbing more carbon dioxide, which is acidic, and corals are they don't like acid. So the acidic nature of the water is actually another threat to corals. So, but if those corals are around seagrass, providing a buffer effect, so it's helping to reduce the pH, so that's one less threat for the corals nearby to have to deal with, which is amazing. And how amazingly intricate all these things are to each other.
That's oh my goodness, that's amazing. I have enjoyed this so much. And I think finally, a question that I would love to ask, because I know that you said there's been many, many moments where you've been surprised, but is there one specific moment that has kind of in a good way shocked you or surprised you about what you've been doing and the journey that you've had so far?
I haven't been able to do any field work at the moment, and that's right. Usually where these amazing moments happen. Mm-hmm. And that's what I would have been doing over the last couple of months, and I'm very, very jealous of all my lovely lab mates who are going out to all these estuaries across South Africa and sending me amazing photos. So I haven't had those kind of in the field or even in the lab, sadly, aha moments. But I think actually despite living on the Isle of Man, I've never been able to dive here. So COVID has presented an unlikely opportunity to be able to do that, and I actually got to dive with seagrass for the first time. And it was amazing. So there was there was jellyfish, there was a grey seal swimming by, checking out what we were doing, and it was stunning. And it was one of those moments where the sun rays are coming through the water, so it's really like this magical, almost Disney-esque moment. And I went with this guy, Tony Glenn, and he knows the things he doesn't know about the surveys around the Isle of Man coast aren't worth knowing. Like one of those guys, I love that. I'm a proper naturalist. And on this patch of seagrass that he took me to go explore, he found a species of sea snail that hadn't been recorded off the Isle of Man for over 150 years.
Wow.
And he showed it to me, and I was like, oh my gosh, it's so unassuming. Mm. And just the whole thing was just so not where I saw this year going, but it was such a great day to be able to see that. And it made me homesick for my seagrass species, but it was one of those really lovely, unexpected, but so worthwhile things to come out of this year. And I think maybe that kind of summarizes 2020, is that hopefully people have been able to kind of find opportunities amongst all the hardship of this year.
That's such a really lovely statement. I love that so much. And I think once everything eventually calms down and you actually do get to go back to South Africa, I think the wait would be so worth it. I think once you get back, you'll be like, oh my god, seagrass.
No, literally, I'll just be like doing seagrass angels, but obviously not because I'm bad for it. But yeah, I think it's just gonna make it so much worth the wait, really. And I'm just really appreciative to my lab mates. They're like really still making me feel so welcome and part of the group, even though they've only known me for 6 weeks, so they've in person. So yeah, they've like South African people are so warm and lovely, and I can't wait to get back. But it's all about your mindset. So I've been trying to make the most of the opportunities whilst I'm here.
Yeah, definitely. I really agree with that. And it's really nice to hear that people, like, I guess people in your group are being so welcoming, because I think that makes the experience even better to have a team that is just so kind and so inviting. I just love that in general about people and about groups and different studies that you do. I think it's a really good way forward.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And my supervisor, Professor Sophie von der Hayden, has been really supportive. She's just said, you know, this year's a writing year, so we'll just nail that this year, and then yeah, you can go come and have all the fun.
I love that so much. That's incredible. But I mean, I've this has been such a pleasure to have you, and to learn your study is just so fascinating to me. And I love all these different topics of science and conservation, because it really enlightens my knowledge as well. And I just wanted to say thank you so much for coming on and taking your time, essentially, to speak to me and to the audience about your study, because I think studies like this are extremely important towards climate change and towards the environmental fluctuations and how it affects people's well-being and sustainability and the way that they live. I think it's absolutely incredible how people are actually studying these things, and I love that, and kudos to yourself, and I wish you nothing but the best for your PhD. I can't wait to hear more about this when it actually finally is published.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's honestly been an absolute pleasure, and I love being able to share the amazing secrets of seagrass that maybe go slightly overlooked. And it's, yeah, just unassuming little gem. So yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's been so much fun. Thanks.
And if you would like to know more about any updates and following podcasts, please follow me at Be Curious Beings. I will leave the link in the description below. Thank you so much, and I look forward to you joining me on the very next Be Curious Beings podcast.